For basically its entire history, America has been a place that business has flocked to. Well, now things are changing, and definitely not for the better. Joining me to discuss this unfortunate turn of events is Patrick Basham, head of the Democracy Institute. Tonight, we will be addressing capital flight from the United States. I'm your host, Joseph Cotto. Patrick, thank you for being here.
You're most welcome, Joseph. Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be back with you and your show, back with your fine audience. Always enjoy our conversations and looking forward to this one very much.
I'm looking forward to it as well. I was going to say, you've been on the show so much lately, it might as well be called Cotto Basham. But
well, let's not. I mean, your respective shows are thriving. You know, you're gaining and gaining an audience and reach, which is much deserved and great to see. So let's not potentially ruin that, kill the baby too early by adding an ominous surname to an otherwise illustrious banner. So let's not reinvent the wheel.
Oh, the episodes that feature you are always interesting. They tend to be audience pleasers. So your name definitely is not something of detraction. But America itself is in a bit of a pickle now, because as you wrote in an opinion piece for the Express, which is an English newspaper, although I believe this was published in the American edition of it, I'll just read the headline. Weaponizing the legal system against Donald Trump is driving away investors from America. Then the byline, the Democracy Institute director Patrick Basham warns that investors are turning their back on America because of a lack of confidence in a weaponized legal system. Now, this is a pretty heavy thing to say, but it's not something that I'm surprised to hear, because I have heard it from others, that the weaponization of the American so-called justice system does create an unfriendly climate for investors who can't be certain that where they put their money will respect their property rights, more or less. Mm-hmm. So this is something else in a very bad way. Before I get into the article, Patrick, anything to say about it starting out?
Yeah, well, I mean, investment from abroad, foreign investment, is one of many ways in which an economy can be supported, can do well, can thrive, can grow. And regardless of the size of the economy, foreign investment is always important. Obviously, a smaller economy at a less mature stage of development is going to be especially impacted by gaining or losing foreign investment. But America, as a capitalist mecca, has not only always been a magnet for foreign capital, because the situation here economically and politically was generally more stable and more open, more transparent, and therefore more productive and profitable than in much of the rest of the world. But it's one that has been, America's been to varying degrees dependent on that, because it is, foreign investment is a part of the entire picture that makes up the American economy. So being hit on the investment, external investment side of the ledger, makes a difference, especially at a time when America is not doing well. It's not a question. It's not a situation where America is thriving economically and can take a minor hit from a drop in foreign investment. Although, of course, if America's thriving, foreign investment investors are sort of clamoring and knocking down the door, as it were, to bring their money into America. America isn't in that advantageous position, quite the opposite. And so the comparative loss of foreign investment is making a bad situation that much worse.
I think there is an interesting question here, because we often hear that America has the most vigorous economy out of all the developed countries, particularly out of all the Western countries. So some might say that, well, considering that America is doing this superbly, there's no need to worry about foreign investment declining when you compare how America is to, say, Germany or the UK, which are in recession. What do you say about this argument?
Well, I think the one sort of crude, but I think appropriate analogy is if you take a group of Olympic sprinters and the American sprinter is in among the top six or eight, but doesn't win. And you could say, well, it would be accurate to say that the American sprinter is very fast, but there are three or four or five others around the world who are even faster, fractions of seconds, over 100 meters, say. And that would be an accurate statement about the quality of the American sprinter in that sort of Olympic 100 meters final, and also an accurate comparison among his or her peers. That isn't the situation. Arguably, that has been the situation for the American economy vis-a-vis other Western countries. You may throw in Japan in the 1980s, perhaps something like that. But today, what we're talking about is we're talking about, in economic terms, an American economy that's crawling along, right? It's got 100 meters to go, but it's crawling there. So it's taking forever, and it's not going in a perfectly straight line. And without any vigor or vitality, or able to exude any confidence, produce confidence in the American spectators, sort of wanting to cheer it on. Now, the others, the British and the German and the Canadian and the French, quote unquote sprinters, they're also on their hands and knees. And some of them are not even crawling as well, relatively speaking, as the American. So you could say, you know, at the 50 meter mark that's taken forever, you can say, well, look, the American sprinter is in first place. By certain metrics, certain arbitrarily chosen metrics, is in first place. Look at the Canadian, the Japanese, and the German, and the French, and the Brits. I mean, they're not as far along. So look how, you know, let's stop complaining. Look how well we're doing. Well, you know, it's taken us half a day to get there. And the only reason we're saying we're doing well is because the others are doing even worse than we are. And that's where the American economy is. It's doing poorly by any objective measure. And most important measure, what is the quality of life of the average American, is clearly on the decline. Now, Britain is doing poorly. The Germans are doing really poorly. The Canadian economy is doing really poorly. The French economy is doing poorly. There's a reason that there are protests and riots and strikes throughout the Western world. Now, this is, what's really important, and I'm sure you know your learned listeners and viewers appreciate this, but I think it's worth repeating, is that the poor shape of the American economy and the poor shape of most, arguably, all Western economies is not because of an act of God or simply bad economic luck. You often have folks, when they acknowledge that things aren't great here or in Canada or in Britain, that the person who I'm reproducing their argument in any of those countries will say, but yes, but you know, inflation or you name the economic ill, it's bad everywhere, as if it's just happened to everyone, right? And of course, the truth is that the economy is poor in America for overlapping reasons to why it's poor in Canada and the UK and Germany and France. And they're all man-made reasons. They're all largely homegrown, domestically induced reasons. Policy mistakes have been made. They've been repeated. They've been added to. And it's not simply about the last couple of years in most of these countries. And these are not just domestic policy mistakes, but foreign policy mistakes. And so we're all suffering. And obviously, when everybody's suffering, there's going to be someone or a couple of countries who aren't suffering quite as acutely at that moment as the others. And they can be pointed out as doing better than others. And if you want to be incredibly half full, then you say, well, look, you know, we're ahead of other Western nations That is, we're not as far behind. And so what's there to, you know, what's there to worry about? You know, move along. There's nothing to see here. You know, in the case of the American economy, Bidenomics is do it working wonders. It is obviously demonstrably untrue. And not only is it untrue, but the cause is as important to recognize the cause and effect as it is the outcome. The outcome is poor, but the cause and effect is terrible policy mistakes. And without recognizing that, those mistakes aren't going to be undone. And it is going to be that much harder for the economy to recover and that much longer for that recovery to take place.
It's a complicated matter because obviously what you say is true. Then though, the narrative is because America so often being compared obviously to other developed countries, because its economy is faring better than, like I said, I brought up examples of the UK and Germany, but there are others. Some would say, oh yes, you know, there's the American success story. But the situation is much bigger than I think the traditional dispute wouldn't be the right word, but traditional, even contest might not be the right word, but just comparing one developed country to another developed country, that's no longer the correct paradigm because the developing world is really, really, it's making itself known. It has done so over the last 20 years, but especially the last 10. It's done so in a way that certainly has not been known before.
This is it. It's not, what's happening in the West isn't in isolation. It's not as if the entire world is the West. And so, as you rightly say, Joseph, if you look at the BRICS nations or Global South, whether it's a formal or informal group, and you just want to choose individual countries in Asia or Africa or the Middle East or even in Latin America, then there are plenty of examples, many, many examples of countries that are doing extremely well. Now, some of them have quote unquote begun from a much lower base, and with the right policies, they are, as most countries do, as markets emerge and go from developing to at least nascent developed economies, the growth rates, etc., tend to be disproportionately high. Although that's not something I think to dismiss or to be concerned about, because it's not a guarantee that because you have a small undeveloped economy that you're easily going to be able to overcome that in a rapid period of time, or that would have happened far more often, far more successfully in much of the world than it obviously has historically, right? But there are more mature economies such as the Gulf states, which, you know, I talk about in the article that you've referenced already, where economic growth is happening at a rate that's, you know, eye-watering rate, but it's built on solid foundations. I mean, we're in a crazy situation, surreal situation in America, where the government has
frozen. I believe he's been frozen. Perhaps he can pop in or pop out and pop back in. But this does happen from time to time. What can one do? But what he brings up is really something else. It's really fascinating. And I think that the world will be paying a lot more attention to the Gulf states in terms of economic growth and results in geopolitical power as the years pass. I think that the Gulf states are definitely going to be something that catch a lot of people off guard, even though they shouldn't, because the growth that's going on there, it's been readily apparent for a few years now, and it's ratcheting up at warp speed. But a lot of people still are not paying attention to it. A lot of people are still in the old paradigm of, say, comparing the U.S. to the U.K. or to Germany, to France, so on and so forth. Obviously, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, blah, blah, blah. But there are some new power players who have shown up, and they are definitely making themselves known. Patrick is back. I'll just add him. Well, actually, I need to There are two Patricks here, and now there's only one. So here we are. Patrick, can you see and hear me? Well, I think I accidentally kicked out the wrong Patrick from the discussion. it's the right Patrick that's here.
Your audience was threatened with. There's a vicious rumor. My whole life among my nearest and dearest family members that there is, believe it or not, such a thing as too much Patrick, and you were about to test that by having me in duplicate, in stereo. So, but fortunately, you were able to, you know, navigate that situation very nimbly, of course, Joseph. And so here we are. Should I continue making the small point I was making? Yeah, I was saying that American fiscal policy, the Biden administration in particular, is conducting this fascinating experiment where the notion is that if we print and borrow enough money, then hey presto, we're going to have incredible prosperity. Of course, this has been tried endless times in modern history. Across many, many economies, and many of them, some of them multiple times. And even if there is a small short-term bump by sort of just, you know, going crazy with the national credit card, it all ends in tears eventually, often quite soon. But what's interesting, to try to put it in academic terms rather than in sort of more personal political terms, is that it's been an abject failure. So America, already, you know, 20 plus billion in trillion in debt, is now what, 34 trillion, I should say, and counting. I mean, we're adding to the debt at a rate that wasn't done in generations, let alone year by year. But we're not getting anything for it, right? We don't have good growth. We don't have rising real wages. We have these manipulated government statistics that pretend that unemployment is low and employment is high, when all the new jobs are government jobs, that is credit card, national credit card jobs and part-time jobs, and folks are working two to three jobs to make ends meet because of the cost of living is so high, et cetera. This is all produced, some would say belatedly, skyrocketing interest rates that mean that mortgage payments and rents are twice what they were. It's just a terrible series of outcomes. These are the kind of outcomes that folks on the left always say will happen if an austerity program is brought in, right? Tighten the national belt, and they always say, well, that means that people in the middle and particularly at the bottom are the ones who are really going to suffer. They're the ones who are going to feel the effects of these cuts in programs and less government involvement in the economy and all of that. But of course, what we're seeing through the opposite approach, the opposite of austerity, just spending like there's no tomorrow, spending like drunken sailors, what we're seeing is terrible outcomes for people in the middle and at the bottom, especially at the bottom. So this obviously makes America not only a less attractive and less affordable place for Americans themselves, but it makes makes America a less attractive place for foreigners to deposit their money in the hope of making more than they would at home or elsewhere. You know, and we have to remember that the foreign investment marketplace is just that. It's a marketplace. It's a competitive environment. And so there potentially is always a better place to put your money as an investor, whether it's corporate or individual, even or government investment. It's not a binary choice. You know, I keep it in Yemen or I put it in America. You potentially have dozens, potentially hundreds of options, right? And America continues to make a hash of her own economic policy, which means that she continues to rapidly ratchet up the signals to the outside world that this isn't a place where your money is either one, going to make more money, or two, even safe to invest because of the way we've politicized economic life in this country.
It really is something what's going on. It's insane the level of, I would say, economic self-harm that this country has done to itself, that certain people in the country, I should say, have done to it. It's not like everybody's conspiring to do this. Before I get into the article, there is one fascinating example, what happened with the lawsuit against the Trump Organization filed by the Attorney General of New York, Letitia James. She is a Democrat who ran on the platform of prosecuting Trump, and her effort proved successful, at least at the district court, the lowest court level. Who knows what will happen on appeal? But at the same time, it's created a very negative climate for investors in New York because Trump was found guilty for quote unquote fraud, even though the people he quote unquote defrauded said they were not defrauded and they'd be glad to do business with him again. And there was no monetary loss to anyone, which sort of runs afoul of the definition of fraud. But the fact of the matter is that the prosecution was so blatantly political and that it was based on something so flimsy, so ridiculous. This is making a lot of people fearful of putting money in New York. Now, the question is, why would a statewide elected official want to do something that would result in less tax revenue, which means less money for the government? Obviously, businesses are chased out. The government suffers because it doesn't have enough money to fund various services. It doesn't have enough money to fund its own administration if things get bad enough. So it's strange that you see this sort of economic self-sabotage being done so gleefully, but it would seem that the people who should care about this for obvious reasons don't. Anything to say, Patrick?
Well, I think, I mean, we could be here, you know, forever discussing why supposedly bright, well-educated people, involve themselves in a sort of collective masochism when it comes to the economy and financial matters. I think it's, there are many reasons, a couple of them to touch on. One is that most of our professional managerial class, most of our expert class, including many of those in economics and finance, or should I say those involved in regulating and telling the rest of us about what's going on in economics and finance, don't actually know anything about economics and finance, and especially don't know anything about business. So there's an ignorance there. That's probably the nicest thing I can say. There's also many of them are and have always been dependent upon the government for their career, financially. And so, again, they have little, if any, experience of the private sector. And so they do not perceive the obvious costs of regulation and of politicizing, of putting politics at the forefront of the regulation of business and the laws underpinning the business and financial worlds, right? And they don't recognize, because they're so ignorant when it comes to economic and financial and business matters, they don't recognize, and if they did, they would not approve of the fact that people and businesses vote with their feet, right? In a country even as semi-free as America is these days, anyone who can get out of these ridiculously weaponized legal systems in the likes of New York and other parts of the country are doing so. Those are obvious negative ripples on the pond from the use of lawfare, the weaponization of politics, the weaponization of the legal and judicial systems for political aims. But it's not obvious to these folks. And when they do figure it out, they don't like it. I mean, there's this surreal situation in states like California and New Jersey, where folks who are leaving either are, depending on which state you're talking about, either are or it's proposed that they will be forced to sort of pay an exit tax, right? For the privilege of leaving an now unlivable or unworkable state ruined by the folks in charge. The folks in charge are now going to penalize you further for leaving. I mean, this is how crazy and how economically illiterate the leadership is in so many parts of America.
It absolutely is crazy, although the craziness is not surprising considering who's been elected to what and who's been entrusted with positions of authority in so-called public service. Very sad stuff, very bleak about the future. One should be very bleak about the future in these areas where there is lawfare. And, you know, all I can say is we'll see what happens, but it certainly does not look inspiring. Now to get to your article. At long last, it begins. The bad news is America is no longer an investment mecca. The good news is other nations are showing us a better way. Why is America losing investors to BRICS nations and the global South? Almost all our economic problems are self-inflicted wounds. We have done them to ourselves, whether through illogical homegrown policies or through the importation of failed foreign ones. American policymakers have their fingerprints all over poor domestic outcomes. Our investment woes fit this model to a T. Integral to America's subpar investment performance is that her policy options are inherently limited by the dominance of the swamp in Washington, D.C. The swamp is a supremely influential, informal coalition of bureaucrats, lobbyists, and careerist politicians in both parties who advance, write, regulate, and vote for statist big government policies with a crony capitalist twist. The swamp's policy agenda bears a striking resemblance to the edicts issued by the globalist elites running the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. These top-down policies expand the welfare state, swell the public sector, overregulate the private sector, shrink property rights, restrict consumer choices, and require high taxes, vast amounts of government spending, and an ever-expanding pool of legal and illegal immigrants. I'll stop reading there. Patrick, anything to say about these words?
Well, I mean, my article fleshes out some of the things we've already touched on in this conversation, Joseph. That is sort of how we do these bad things to ourselves. You know, we have these, we spend money we don't have. We grow government, which is, you know, inherently unproductive. We overregulate the private sector. So we suffocate the private sector. I mean, whatever one thinks of the evil capitalist running these, whether it's a mom and pop business or a major corporation, the reality that those who are all about big interventionist government and would love most people to be working for the government, the problem they face at some point is that the government doesn't produce anything. It doesn't create anything. It doesn't add value. It doesn't create wealth. It taxes, regulates, redistributes wealth, etc. Obviously has an enormous power and influence, but it's playing with other people's money, whether it's the taxpayers' monies in general or the value, the products and the profits, products manufactured and the profits created by private business. And so one can have the most negative view of private business owners, yet they remain the only source of economic wealth. So if you're on the left and you want to redistribute lots of money forever to all kinds of people and groups, etc., and the government in particular, as the distributor or the halfway house of those funds, you've still got to have a source of that wealth in the first place, you know, which is the private sector. But we're doing everything in this country to suffocate, strangle the private sector. And we're making up the difference, such as it is, by simply spending money, borrowing money we don't have, right? So we're in a situation where within a few years, we're looking at somewhere between 40 to 50% of the revenue the government receives in taxes is going to go straight out the door in interest payments, right? So you just think about that as a consumer, as a household, as an individual. If, you know, 40 to 50% of your gross income is automatically going out to pay credit card debt, right? You know, where does that leave you? Obviously, in a pretty bad spot pretty quickly. And we have no plan to get out of this. It's not as if, you know, this is all going to end in 6 months or 12 months because of some national emergency, right? There is no plan. The plan is just to spend and spend and tax, and because the electoral arithmetic, it is those who have these policies in place, you know, believe that will favor them as a consequence of that. So we're doing this to ourselves. We're making ourselves not only as poor economically as we can, but as unattractive to the outside world as possible. And it's not just about domestic policy, it's also about foreign policy. So that's sort of, you know, that's the ground that I was trying to lay, you know, in the introductory parts to my op-ed.
You favorably raised Argentina. You bring it up as a place that's doing something which other countries, of course, including the United States, should learn from. Argentina is typically a place that people figure out what it's doing and then do the opposite when it comes to economics, among other things. So what is Argentina doing right at the moment?
Well, Argentina's new libertarian president, free market president, you know, he has a very charismatic, convivial, humor-laden public personality, but he's a very serious economist. And he said that if he was elected, he would eliminate various government departments and agencies. He would cut spending. He would get inflation under control. He would deregulate the economy. He would adopt the adopt the U.S. dollar. He would tie the Argentinian peso to the dollar, et cetera, et cetera. And he was told by the experts, of course, that either these were bad ideas or they were simply unenforceable, unimplementable. Well, of course, he's only been in office a very short time, and he's already managed to, at least on paper, balance the budget, because he turns out he meant what he said. And so he's cutting wherever he can. There's no guarantees, obviously, but it looks like he has the best approach, the most probable approach to stabilize and actually grow successfully the Argentinian economy. And you have to remember, he was, you know, for a libertarian, for a free market person to be elected, a non-politician to be elected president in a country such as Argentina, a historically sort of statist, corporatist, populist in a left-wing sense electorate. Things had to be pretty bad, and they were pretty bad under the center-left, corporatist, globalist incumbents. And you know, and whichever party was in power, predictably things didn't get much better. In fact, there's a question: did they get a little bit worse or a lot worse? Well, they were a lot worse by the time the new president was elected, and that's why he was elected. So, the average Argentinian was, for the first time in a long time, perhaps ever, really willing to say, okay, you know, have at it. You do your quote unquote radical thing, and we'll keep our fingers and toes crossed. And so he has a small window, a small political window to try to transform, or at least begin to transform, the Argentinian economy. And the signs, as I say, are encouraging, because he's actually doing what he said he would do. And I would suggest that the, you know, economic history in Latin America and elsewhere tells us that a more free market approach and a more limited government approach is going to be the one that grows the economy more successfully, more sustainably, and has the greater benefits for everyone. Whether you're looking to keep the profits that you make from your business or your high income, or you're trying to climb out of poverty, so that's good news for Argentinians. The other thing that's good news for Argentinians, I think, going forward, is that their economy is going to make that country more attractive to foreign investors. The president's predecessor really just paid lip service to the notion of foreign investment, which is what those on the left usually do, because they're suspicious of foreigners coming in with their checkbooks, unless those foreigners are foreign governments of a left-wing persuasion, or maybe the Chinese are usually welcome in many places with their extraordinarily large checkbooks and huge credit cards. So that, you know, that that's a different political dynamic. But he is saying Argentina is once again open for business, not just within, as in for Argentinians, but for the rest of the world. So he's making all kinds of explicit, overt moves on the international stage, both within the Latin America, the Western Hemisphere, but beyond, to tell the world this is different. Okay, this Argentina is different now. And that your capital is welcome here, and that you, the economy here is going to be doing sufficiently well that you should really consider bringing your money here. I mean, even, you know, to his eternal credit, he went to Davos, went to the World Economic Forum. I'm not sure he'll get a second invitation. And he gave a fantastic speech in which he basically said all that should and needed to be said about why the World Economic Forum is not the answer to the world's economic or other ills, but it demonstrated to the world that he was different and he had a different story to tell about Argentina. It's the complete opposite approach, both in style and substance, to what we're seeing here in America and throughout most of the West, where our leaders don't understand economics, don't care to. What they think they know is all wrong, and they implement policies that are destined to fail. And when they do fail, they deny they fail and deny, and therefore double down on those failed policies. So Argentina, I say, there are no guarantees, obviously, in economic life and policymaking, but it's certainly perhaps one of the, perhaps the country to follow over the next 6, 12, 18 months, because there are exciting things happening there. And I suspect that a year or two from now, we're going to say that Argentina is in a much more favorable position than she was when its first libertarian president was elected.
I really do think that Argentina is a potential success story. I think that there can be a tremendous deal of good which comes out of the reforms which Milei is making. Time will tell, but it looks like they're on solid ground for something really spectacular. I hope it lasts, because Argentina has had some notorious boom-bust cycles, but typically its prosperity is completely unsustainable because it's rooted in spending, which produces a short-term boom, but then, you know, the bus comes in and so do the political consequences. Now, there is something else, somewhere else, I should say, you brought up in your article as an example of good tidings. I think that's probably the best way of putting it. Riyadh, which is emerging as an international city, as a hub for finance, among other things. What it makes Riyadh so important from your perspective?
Well, what's happening in Riyadh and in Saudi Arabia more broadly, and actually among most of the Gulf, Arab Gulf states more generally, is that they have decided that change is necessary, but uncharacteristic of most policymakers, they are adopting sensible changes rather than bad ones. I mean, that's, I'm putting it simplistically, but that's really where we're at. So you have a situation where the Saudis, the new crown prince, we're talking sort of less than a decade, that MBS, as he's known, has been quote unquote in charge, and in other Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia, a recognition that living forever on oil wealth not only would be a risk, but it also self-limiting in all kinds of ways. So a decision was made several years ago to diversify the Saudi economy. And what that involved was not a decision or set of decisions as has been the case historically in many countries, where that means the government suddenly starts taking over other areas of the economy and spending money and basically being the player trying to sort of build something that wasn't there. What the Saudis decided was that they needed to take a page out of the sort of free market playbooks of the likes of Margaret Thatcher and other successful policymakers of another era. And they needed to not add government to the Saudi economy, to free up the Saudi economy so that non-oil sectors had the opportunity to grow and potentially blossom. So that effort requires, yes, there's a lot of wealth in Saudi Arabia, but it requires input from the rest of the world, capital input, in terms of financial capital, human capital input, and it requires the rest of the world taking another fresh look at Saudi Arabia. So to do so, the Saudis have liberalized their economy. They've making an incredibly concerted effort to attract foreign investment and to invest more elsewhere. So to be more interwoven with the global economy, both the Western economy, but also the global South, and the BRICS countries, for example. And so you have the Saudis recognizing that they have this very highly educated, work ethic oriented, domestic sort of population labor pool. And that if they adopt a light regulatory touch, if they maintain the favorable tax regime. So for example, there's no income tax in Saudi Arabia. There's a low flat tax on capital, on corporate tax, which varies somewhat depending on whether you're Saudi or non-Saudi, but it's an incredibly favorable situation compared with the West. And you put that on top of the fact there's no income tax. All these sorts of things are really important. And in addition to that, a particular emphasis on transparency, right? So not something that the Arab nations and their economic lives have been especially known for, but a recognition that the Saudi, not just the economy needed to modernize, but the Saudi approach to presenting that economy to the world needed to modernize. So a great emphasis on transparency. And one of the things that's underlined all this, if you're going to modernize your economy, you can't keep half or more than half the population as second-class citizens. So the women in Saudi Arabia, I'm not suggesting that they have moved forward from a Western perspective to the extent that one would hope or like. However, the gain, the political, cultural, and economic gains that Saudi women have undergone has been quite amazing over the last, just over a few years. You have a situation now, you know, where Saudi women own businesses, which they didn't do before. There's something like 300,000 businesses that are owned by Saudi women. They are elected, they're standing for office, they're elected to office. They have a say where they really didn't have one before. And this both presents a new face to the world, which means that Western companies, which are increasingly concerned about diversity and these other issues, find it easier and more attractive to invest there. But it also means that the potential, economic potential of women is no longer held down, constrained. And so the Saudi economy is benefiting from the fact that more and more women are in the labor force, and there are more and more professional women and skilled women, et cetera. So the Saudi economy is growing, you know, close to double digits on an annual basis. And it's real sustainable growth. It's not simply using, you know, the national credit card to rack up debt and present a mirage of growth. And so what, you know, is you're familiar with now, Joseph, you know, 7 years ago, the Saudi government started funding an annual investment conference in Riyadh, the Future Investment Initiative, which is now run by a Saudi-based think tank. And that has become, it's gone from a small conference now to a conference that really does rival Davos in terms of who attends, but more importantly, I think outdoes and outpaces Davos and the World Economic Forum, because it actually proposes, you know, commonsensical prescriptions that are based in the real world and not fanciful status notions that come down from the ski slopes in Davos every January. So the Saudis are putting a very strong foot and face forward. And they're showing much of the rest of the world and America, if America was paying attention, that common sense fiscal and economic policy, common sense financial regulation, common sense regulation of business, still does do the trick in terms of retaining and attracting investment. It's a lesson we must relearn in the West. It's just hard to have a lot of confidence that our current set of leaders, in inverted commas, will have the sense to do so.
There really is a lack of an appetite for innovation among many in the West, certainly not all. We will get into momentarily Miami, and you know, obviously it's where the FII held its priority summit. Held in Miami Beach, but people typically loop in Miami Beach and Miami. As one sees with New York, as one sees with California, New Jersey, so on and so forth, you have these states with big economies, but these states are in decline because while they are legacy brands, the legacy brands no longer provide the benefits which can be found elsewhere. The competitors have a leg up. Where are the competitors? Well, South Dakota, bizarre as that might sound, Texas, Florida, obviously, yeah, to a lesser extent, Tennessee. There are some other places too. But the fact of the matter is, there just doesn't seem to be an interest among people in these legacy brand states. How do I put this as kindly as possible? They don't seem interested in doing what it takes to make their economies as dynamic as possible, which obviously benefits the people who live there. Anything to say about that, Patrick?
No, you're absolutely right, Joseph. Where America is doing well, the parts of America, the Floridas, the Texas, the Tennessees, the Dakotas, as you note, these are states that in terms of economic policy still recognize or have newly re-recognized that entrepreneurship and innovation and dynamism and disruption and creativity are not just neat concepts to talk about, you know, in management consulting seminars, in TED Talks. These are actually the building blocks of economic growth. These are the pillars upon which, you know, that support a strong economy. And in the legacy, in the Californias and the New Yorks and New Jerseys, et cetera, as you say, these lessons have been long forgotten. And I think because these states are now so government-centric, they're so statist in mindset and in application, that there are so few people in and around, holding and in and around the levers of power who recognize that statism is the problem, not the solution, right? And that limited government and an entrepreneurial society is the solution. That the change just simply doesn't happen because it's never even thought of in the first place. That is the right kind of change. You know, change is always seen as either, you know, tweaking the wrong prescription, playing around with the status quo, or a more radical version of the status quo that makes the situation that much worse, right? So this is what we're seeing nationally. We've gone from budget deficits and a considerable federal debt. And instead of even making the pretense publicly that, well, we agree debts and deficits aren't a good thing, but, you know, we don't want to crash the economy, so we're going to tweak it here and there. And, you know, Bill Clinton, you know, let's get to a balanced budget. That's what Democrats were saying in the 90s. But today, there's not even a pretense. It's just let's spend as much as we can. You know, deficits and debt don't matter. The whole modern monetary theory nonsense that we had to hear about during the Obama years, and now we've had to suffer during the Biden years. So those states, it's hard to see, absent a complete economic collapse, how the political players and the larger economic players who are doing okay in that crony capitalist environment where the big dogs get to eat regardless because they have so much control over the system, so much influence, and it's everybody else who suffers. It's hard to see how they make the changes themselves, which means the good news then is for the Tennessees and the Texases and the Dakotas and the Floridas is that business continues to flee to those states, right? So that's what's happening in America is that bad states are losing good business to good states, but the country as a whole is losing business to other parts of the world, Saudi Arabia being a good example, right? So it's a situation that could change and could change quite quickly. We could do an Argentina, but are we not simply brave enough, but are we enlightened enough? Are we knowledgeable enough, right? Are we commonsensical enough to do that?
That is one interesting question, to say the least. I don't think I have an answer in mind, but I don't think you'd necessarily like to hear it. But there is sort of a bright spot when it comes to this global innovation taking place. I mean, there are several bright spots. I'm talking about a bright spot in the U.S. It is Miami and Miami Beach. They've become these international hubs for finance and tech. And Florida never used to have a big finance and tech. Finance sector or tech sector. Miami eventually became the banking capital of Latin America, but that was specific to Latin America. Really wasn't something of tremendous consequence for much beyond that. But now it's, you know, Miami's just taken off in ways that are too immense to describe here. But you do see this the sort of trend that's bringing places that have been overlooked into positions of prominence, such as Riyadh. You see the same trend taking place in Miami. You and I both spent some time in Dade County, which is where Miami and Miami Beach are. We did so recently for the FII's Priority Summit. And certainly, we both were able to see a great deal of what's going on in the area. What is your impression of the economic boom in Miami? And what does it tell you about what can be done elsewhere in the U.S.? I think Patrick is frozen again. If he would drop in, or I should say drop out and drop back in, that would be great. But I was going to say that, since I have a bit of extra time now, Miami really is spectacular in how far it's come. It's not at all what it used to be or what a lot of people would imagine it to be even today. It really has become something innovative, to say the least, something dynamic, a city of global importance, not just the northernmost reach of Latin America, or as it was even before that, a retiree haven for folks from the north. Anyway, I think Patrick is back now. Patrick, you can see and hear, correct?
I can indeed, yes. Yeah, great. I would say that Miami is a wonderful demonstration that neither a city nor a state nor a country is fated to remain as it is today or as it was yesterday. And of course that can go in a good or bad direction, but you know, we had under Obama, there was growth, but it was low growth. But what the Obama experts told us was that, I mean, that's just in the modern world, that's simply all you can hope for, right? Ignoring, you know, because they didn't want to acknowledge that all their overregulation, all their taxes, etc., were keeping business down. And it was largely government spending that was keeping things going. Then Trump comes along, he deregulates, he cuts taxes. And guess what? The economy starts to grow at much higher rates, which was impossible, the experts told us. Then Biden comes along and he re-regulates. And it's the re-regulation, et cetera, is so bad, it's over the top, that even the crazy through-the-roof government spending still doesn't move the economy. We're back to, are we in recession? Are we in a stagnation? Are we with low growth? My point is that each of those three, this contemporaneous and most recent history, those two phases under Trump and Obama, they demonstrated what we're seeing in states like New York or California or Florida or Texas or in cities like Miami, that policy matters. Okay, you can change, you can make mistakes and make things worse, think Joe Biden and Bidenomics, or you can change things and make things better. You know, whether it's Ron DeSantis in Florida, or Governor Abbott in Texas, or, you know, the mayor of Miami. You can do things, not because government should is the determining factor whether things go well or badly, but the government creates an environment more by doing less than by doing more. And so in Miami, as in Florida more generally, the approach in recent times has been to allow business to do its thing, to get out of the way of the private sector, to not inhibit business startups and business growth, business development, and to encourage investment from the rest of the country and from outside of the country, to recognize that innovation in technology and in other sectors is potentially very helpful, and to not be a hindrance to those nascent industries getting off the ground and potentially and developing, potentially thriving. So the city of Miami, just like Florida more generally, or most of Florida, maybe outside of Tallahassee and perhaps Jacksonville, has shown the rest of the country, or certainly much of the rest of the country, that you don't have to accept a sort of humdrum, barely eking out an existence, you know, future. It doesn't have to be that way. It wasn't always that way, and it doesn't have to be that way ad infinitum. You know, you can change things, but to change things, you have to have, I think, a critical mass of your population, or at least your influential segments of your population, clued in as to what's necessary. So whether by their votes or whether their political influence, they impress upon our elected representatives that change is necessary, and you need a certain segment of that political class to appreciate, whether it's for substantive policy reasons or simply for political survival, that change is necessary, and that certain changes are the appropriate and requisite ones. So it's a lot that's required, but we see in Miami, we see in Florida, we see elsewhere in America, that those variables that are required for that change equation to come to the fore and to carry the day politically, it can happen. It is possible. The rest of the country doesn't have to become California and New York and New Jersey. You know, it is not too late to halt regression in that direction. And there's no reason why the likes of Florida and Texas cannot continue to progress in, thankfully, the opposite direction.
It definitely is encouraging what's going on in parts of Florida and parts of Texas. I'd also add Orlando to the list of cities in Florida that are definitely not worth going out of your way to visit. But anyway, there are a great deal of good things going on in certain places across the U.S. Just have to bring up the good since we're discussing so much of the bad. And getting back to the bad, as we begin to draw closer towards wrapping things up, at the end of your article, it is written, "While America's loss of economic strength, freedom, and competitiveness significantly reduced her attractiveness to foreign and domestic investors, good old-fashioned political interference was the final straw. Sanctions on Russian-owned businesses and businessmen told the non-Western world that should America and her allies decide you are politically beyond the pale, directly or by association, they also consider your corporate and personal assets among the spoils of war. This precarious investment climate scared foreign investors away from dependence upon the West's U.S. dollar-dominated financial system. Investors migrated to other financial coalitions, including the ever-expanding BRICS, cryptocurrencies, and alternative fiat currencies. The weaponization of the legal and judicial systems to punish financially the government's political opponents, known as lawfare, is running riot across Biden's America." That is the high note upon which Patrick's article ends. Patrick, anything to say about what I just read?
Well, it's a recognition. What I'm trying to emphasize there is that it's not simply bad economic policy. It's bad legal and judicial policy. That is inserting politics to the degree and to the extent that it overwhelms the legal and judicial systems, so that it, these systems, in many cases, in terms of their application towards businesses and individual business men and women, politics dominates the calculus there on the, in terms of who's investigated, who's prosecuted, et cetera, et cetera. We see that obviously in the case of Donald Trump in New York is the example of the day. And naturally, unsurprisingly, at least, you know, except to decision makers in New York, businesses are fleeing New York as a consequence, which is good news for the likes of Florida, obviously. But it's also about foreign policy. So if you go back 2 years, almost to the day, when America and most Western nations started bringing in sanctions on Russia and Russians and Russian businesses inside and outside of Russia, even if one thought that they might succeed in halting the Russian invasion, or if you were naive enough to think that that the unwritten reason for the sanctions to bring down the Russian economy, therefore to bring down Putin, could succeed, even if you thought those were worthwhile challenges to undertake,
I believe Patrick has frozen once again. Hopefully he can join back in as soon as possible. Some nights there are just issues with the internet. On other nights there aren't. What are you going to do? It's part of life. It's just something we all have to deal with. Heaven knows I've had my internet connectivity issues. But anyway, I hope Patrick's able to join us, because what he was discussing is absolutely fascinating. And it really is sad that there is this condition in the United States now, which entails people no longer feeling that they are will be treated fairly enough in one jurisdiction or another to invest there. That's something very third world, something very disturbing, to say the absolute least. And it's something I think we're going to see a lot more of, because a lot of folks, they just don't seem to have any interest in having a more stable judicial climate, one without, shall we say, fear or favor. They don't care that this would result in more economic prosperity. They just want to go through with their political agenda, which is better described as a vendetta. And that is that. And the consequences of it, the costs of it, can be measured in dollars and cents, as well as opportunities denied and dreams destroyed. Patrick, now that I have shared my thoughts on that, please continue.
Yeah, I was just would have continued to say, Joseph, that when you apply really tough sanctions on a government and on businesses and on individuals inside and outside that country, that is going to have ramifications. It is a signal to, now you think, you know, we as the country doing the sanctioning, you think, oh, it's a signal to bad actors not to misbehave. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But what it is also a signal, is a signal to businessmen and women and businesses and governments elsewhere that their money, their businesses, their assets, corporate and private, aren't safe in your jurisdictions. Okay, so many BRICS nation, you know, businesses and individuals in BRICS nations, the global south, etc., now believe, and there's a, you know, there's every reason to believe, that there's no point in putting money or even keeping money in America and Western nations, because if they fall foul one day to the political winds that turn against their country for whatever reason, then their businesses, their assets, their personal futures, their personal financial lives could disappear overnight. And so that's why investment isn't, or is one of the reasons, the compounding reason why investment isn't simply leaving America for other Western nations. It's leaving Western nations on the whole and going to other countries, other jurisdictions, other marketplaces that are much more favorable. And so we have this counterintuitive situation where Western nations, which have been viewed particularly by themselves as liberal democracies, where obviously the rule of law takes precedent, the political system is calm and transparent, everyone has their day in court, the judicial system and the law is applied evenly and fairly in a balanced way. The judicial system applies a balanced sort of blindfolded approach. As that becomes manifestly not true, no longer, if it ever was, the rest of the world, many countries are like Saudi Arabia, are beginning to look like better bets, not simply in terms of how a business is regulated and taxed in that jurisdiction, but how the legal system will be applied to those businesses. I mean, that's an incredible change. I mean, good for these, for the Saudi Arabias and potentially the Argentinas of this world, but it says terrible things about the reputation of America and many of her Western peers, both in economic, political, and judicial terms.
It is a sad thing indeed. That's putting it kindly. It's a very sad thing, and I think it's only going to get worse, because the thing of it is the self-interest motivation that politicians should have to have businesses in their vicinity, because this results in more tax revenue, which is ultimately good for people in the government. This incentive does not seem to be felt or acknowledged by people who should at least have some understanding of it, namely the people who are running things in places like New York and California and New Jersey, Illinois. And so it's like these people are just willing to destroy whatever economic vitality remains. Meanwhile, they lose people continuously to other places and their revenue base shrinks and they can't have these policies, these social spending policies that they love so much. It's really strange. You'd think that they would notice the connection, but if they do notice it, it's that they don't care. And if they don't notice it, I mean, that says something about them profoundly.
Yeah, I agree, Joseph. I think it's what it is that the policymakers, the decision makers in these statist jurisdictions, they apply sort of their subscribers to an adolescent model of economics, right, and finance and business. So they do believe there is a free lunch, because, you know, if you're 13 or 15 years old, odds are your parents or the government provides you with that lunch at no charge, right? And they do think that the money is a bottomless pit, because someone, perhaps their parents, perhaps somebody else, will bail them out. And, you know, the credit card isn't theirs, it's their parents. And so, well, you know, it'll get paid, won't it? And there's no sense of consequence. There's no sense that there are, you know, there are ripples on the pond, that there are unintended consequences. These are things that you either indulge, recognize, appreciate, educate when it comes to adolescence, because they are young and they are inexperienced and they are unworldly, and they have to personally and more broadly learn certain lessons so that they can operate successfully as adults in the economy, in the world of business, in the world of finance. But we're talking about adults who are no longer adolescents by definition, but apply an adolescent mentality, adherence to an adolescent model of economics, business, and finance, where there really aren't any serious consequences for their actions. And like adolescents, many of their decisions are driven by emotion and feeling and sentiment. I want this. I don't like that. If something, quote unquote, bad happens, I want to punish someone for that. I'm going to, you know, my reactions are going to be over the top. They're not going to be measured. They're not going to be mature. I'm going to say things whether I mean them or not, regardless of the consequences, because I don't have yet the self-control required to act in a mature adult way. And these are the things that we see the prosecutors and the politicians and the bureaucrats and the judges saying and doing and believing in these jurisdictions that are using politics to from their point of view, punish bad actors in the private sector or bad actors in the political sphere who have an economic, financial angle to their element to their lives that can be used as a target by our very adolescent, in inverted commas, leaders in these jurisdictions. So there's so many, there are so many reasons why we're suffering under the weight of our alleged betters. What isn't so numerous are the options and opportunities for us to do something about that, at least in the short term.
Obviously, the most available remedy is voting, and that's what millions upon millions of people are going to be doing this year. We shall see how that goes. Needless to say, there are plenty of distractions from the bread and butter issues of economics, but it does look like people are really prioritizing the economy this year, although immigration has become a massive issue, which obviously relates to economics. So it's really... It's an interesting time in America, to say the absolute least. As I tell Patrick sometimes off camera, he picked a very interesting country to immigrate to.
Well, yes, my timing may not have been the most judicious, to put it like that. But you're right about the economy, Joseph. America's reaching, I think it's fair to say, a fork in the road. In policy terms, some would say in cultural terms, but in policy / political terms in regarding this November's election, I suspect that the alternatives, the choices will be fairly clear. Clearly there are a lot of people on both sides who have very strong feelings about what isn't or isn't happening right now, what is going well, what's going poorly. But the priorities of Americans, economics, immigration, crime, these are the priorities of that dominate public sentiment and public anxieties when things aren't going well. So it's an environment that is inherently unfavorable to the incumbent. One would presume, and so far the empirical data backs this up, that it's going to be very hard for the incumbent to survive past November in such an inherently inauspicious environment. However, we have learned from recent American elections, arguably from some far back as well, but certainly in recent times, that what everyone knows or believes is going to happen isn't necessarily what happens in terms of electoral outcomes. So, you know, one cannot, whether one views a change in November as a highly positive, potentially highly positive outcome or not, one certainly cannot be assured of that outcome.
We shall definitely see what happens. It's going to be an interesting election. It already is a very interesting election cycle. Before we go, Patrick, there is something to bring up, which is your Super Tuesday polling, the Democracy Institute Super Tuesday polling. I think most people know that the DI does polling for the Express, and you had a very good track record on Super Tuesday.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Joseph. Yeah, we did very well. For example, our Texas poll, we predicted that Donald Trump would win by 63 points over Nikki Haley. He won by 61. In California, we predicted he would win by 61, and he won by 61. So we're very pleased with those outcomes, and we would argue the two most important states and very different states on Super Tuesday. But their differences make them uniquely difficult to poll. You know, we had a very successful Iowa caucus poll, a very successful, by successful, I mean accurate Iowa caucus poll, a New Hampshire poll. We had a good Super Tuesday. So it's encouraging to us that we're sort of on the right track in terms of measuring public sentiment and, most importantly, not just what people think, but actually how they vote, which of course is where the rubber hits the road. And I suppose the bottom line for us is that for all our polling's failings or imperfections, I think even our enemies would acknowledge that we seem to have a pretty good handle on the Trump vote, both in the Republican Party and more broadly in the larger national electorate. So that encourages us that if you know to continue doing more of what we do, and hopefully we'll be able to continue to offer Americans and those outside of America interested in the American election a sort of an accurate assessment of Trump's prospects and Biden's prospects between now and the election in November.
I just have to ask this before we go. Have you ever received any apologies or any at least better coverage from the media outlets that said terrible, terrible things about the DI? Because the DI probably is America's most unduly hated controversial polling outlet, which is interesting because you do have a very good track record, relatively speaking, which is to say relative to other polling firms. But yet you are so often raked over the coals. It's crazy. Has anybody done anything in the way of a mea culpa? Oh, I believe Patrick has frozen once again, which is, it's never good when somebody freezes, but it's good that he froze right after I finished asking my question. This way he doesn't have to start and stop in the middle of an answer. And now I see that Patrick is back again, but let me just make sure I kick his duplicate from the studio. I mean, it would get a little confusing to have three Patrick Bashams on at once, or would have been two Patrick Bashams on at once. Anyway, Patrick, please go ahead.
So not just confusing, Joseph, but terrifying, probably.
not at all.
No, sorry. If I heard your question correctly before the online gremlins kicked me out, no one who said anything unpleasant about us has either apologized nor changed their tune. They just ignore us. Whereas those who sort of all along or have discovered us more recently have found our work useful, continue to say positive things when they think that we merit them. And we're grateful and appreciative of that. So, but, you know, as we've discussed ad nauseum over the years now, we don't poll because we either seek or like, adulation from those who we don't concern ourselves with. You know, we're concerned, our clients are the number one concern, that they're happy with what the work we do, and they generally are, and that most, you know, and in an intellectual sense, in an educational sense, our priority is that our work is a reasonably accurate assessment of public sentiment and voter intention, and that we continue to get better at it, as we learn from our own mistakes and errors, and we learn, you know, where we're getting it right and try to do more of the same.
And I just have to add before we go that what's happened with the media and the Democracy Institute, the mainstream media to be precise, which malign the Democracy Institute, it's indicative of what happens in these states wherein terrible things are done. And basically, there's a state of affairs that's not based upon merit. It's based upon ideology where there's a predetermined outcome regardless of the facts. And economically, the end result is what's happening now in New York. But with polling, the end result is a firm like the DI getting blacklisted, even though it's more accurate than a lot of the so-called gold standard polling firms that get all these accolades from various media sources. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing that this transpires. But it goes to show how merit is not what matters to many of the powers that be in modern America. And that is something which everyone should pause and reflect on in a very disturbed fashion.
Absolutely, Joseph. And I'm sure it's just coincidental that once you've brought up this issue of criticism of our polling, et cetera, that the internet gremlins have really gone into overdrive. Fortunately, neither you nor I are conspiracy theorists. So we know that this stuff just happens, and we'll let your large and ever-growing audience of listeners and viewers make up their own minds as to the utility of our conclusion about the coincidental nature of all of this. But no, your point about merit, I think, is really interesting because our polling, we stand by our polling when it's a rise or fall based on its accuracy, which is there for everyone to examine, our public polling, as do the other pollsters that I think are doing a great job out there. It's the, you know, but we live in a society, it's not just an American issue, but around the West, we seem to be in a society where failing up is really the thing to do. There are so many people in so many fields, that is those without a bottom line, without a financial bottom line, where failing up is the flavor of the, maybe the decade, let alone not just the day. So what you're saying, I think is it has a lot of utility. One just has to sort of, you know, push that aside and just move forward, because you can't reason with folks who don't care about merit, who only care about politics. I mean, politics is important, but to politicize everything is obviously not only irrational, but probably insane. So, you know, like yourself, we simply move forward trying to do good work, and we're appreciative that there are enough people and a growing number of people who recognize that we're doing that. And that encourages us to hopefully do more of the same.
Absolutely. Obviously, every time somebody says something nasty or does something nasty, it presents an opportunity to better oneself, to sort of rise above the attacks. And every day one does this, the likelihood goes up that CNN burns in hell. And I say that somebody doesn't even believe in hell, but I saw some recent audience stats about CNN, and it does look like they're coming pretty close to circling the drain. So, you know, hope springs eternal, but in this case it looks like finally that hope might pay off sooner than later.
The marketplace, despite the left's best efforts, the marketplace does still matter in America, as so many woke businesses are finding out to their literal cost. There is some poetic justice going on, whether one views it to be divine intervention or simple or karma, or some of our spiritual friends might put it, or simply just chickens coming home to roost, as my grandmother might have put it.
People look at it however they want. I'm just glad to be looking at CNN's terrible situation, because that in its own way is the most obnoxious of any major so-called news outlet. Anyway, Patrick, this has been an outstanding discussion. Thank you very much for stopping by tonight.
Thank you, Joseph. Always enjoyed this as much as the previous ones. I apologize for the technological glitches, but I think I'm only to blame for the early ones. The more recent ones perhaps were beyond my control.
I can hear the black helicopter whirring outside.
Yeah, perhaps I'd better go quickly.
I think that perhaps they, whoever they might be, let us wrap this up, since there's only about a minute or so, less than a minute left.
should I be generous enough to invite me again, my next appearance? Perhaps I'll conduct it from an undisclosed location.
Why not? In this day and age, so many crazy things have happened that you can hardly discount anything. It's absolutely bizarre. That is, as I always say, America 2024. That basically sums it all up. Patrick, like I said, thank you for stopping by. Glad we were able to have this conversation. We covered a great deal of ground. And I hope everybody watching this found the chat to be as interesting as Patrick and I did. Please, everyone, stay safe, be well, and cheers.